30th of August 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. War, huh? What is it good for? Well, it's good for giving us lots to talk about, because this week we're talking about, do humanitarian interventions actually work? And has anyone asked any academics? Why is there a taboo against chemical weapons, and why are they so disgusting? Should we be worrying about the Black Death? And should we boycott the Sochi Olympics? But before we begin, the traditional begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All the donations are really appreciated and help us keep making the show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can also find links to my CV. Yes, I'm still looking for a job. If you'd like to employ me, find my CV there. Now we start this week with Syria, which last week earned a promotion to the top spot in the Axis of Evil by gassing hundreds of children. So what should we do about it? Well, if you're a newspaper columnist, then chances are that you'll know exactly what the right thing to do is, because you're paid to think in black and white to a deadline. But if you're a member of the rest of the population, then chances are that you think the situation is pretty horrible and complicated and messy, and basically a massive ball ache. So this week we start by looking at the data. Last night I spoke to Reed M. Wood, Associate Professor of Political Science at Arizona State University, who last year co-wrote a paper analysing the effects of external interventions on civil wars in countries. So basically exactly what's probably going to happen in Syria. The paper looked at the link between interventions and increases or decreases in violence against civilians. So I started by asking Reed if he thinks it's relevant to Syria. Yes, this interview was recorded before David Cameron lost that vote, so just pretend any reference to us is me actually just pronouncing US wrongly.
I'd like to think so, although I guess I should start by saying that we're not making any kind of, and I do have co-authors in the paper, Jacob Kathman, State University, New York, Buffalo, and Stephen Gent at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and of course I'm at Arizona State University. But I guess it's useful to start by pointing out that our intention was not to make a policy recommendation, and we certainly weren't focusing on any specific case or contemporary scenario. So we're not making a recommendation about what should be done in a context like Syria. We'll leave that for policymakers. Of course, we do like to think that our research should hopefully, to some degree or another, kind of inform policy decision making.
And I guess one of the major themes in your paper, you're trying to determine whether interventions lead to sort of greater violence against civilians.
That's correct. That was the intention of the paper, was to see how biased interventions, and I suppose we should also clarify what we mean here. We're not talking about, say, peacekeeping interventions. Neutral is a term that people often use. More correctly, it would be to say impartial interventions, such as the United Nations might carry out. So we're really not talking about peacekeeping, you know, impartial peacekeeping missions. We're specifically looking at biased, militarized intervention by a foreign party, a state, or it could be a collection of states, say the NATO intervention in Afghanistan, or the U.S.-led and British coalition in Iraq. Those are the types of interventions that we're looking at that would be biased and have an objection of challenging a state or a rebel group. I mean, we do actually look at both sides of the coin, so we're not limiting ourselves to just interventions against state leaders, for example.
Well, what I thought was interesting was that you drew a direct link between the sort of capabilities of the different sides in the Civil War with the likelihood of attacking civilians, basically. So does your work fit with the sort of narrative we've seen in Syria that he used chemical weapons because he's backed into a corner and has nothing left to use, whereas, I guess, before he observed this international norm because he still had a relatively effective fighting force in the past?
Yeah, I think it goes to that pretty closely, and we could use that as an example. Increasingly, what we're finding in the Civil War literature, the empirical literature from political science and conflict studies, is that not so much the total capabilities available to an actor shape its decisions regarding, say, violence against civilians or mass killing, but it shifts in the power relationships. So violent political actors, states, and rebel groups alike have a tendency we see, or the pattern we see emerging, is that when they lose ground in a conflict, when they're losing control over territory, when they're suffering troop losses or defections, they tend to lash out. So I think there's something to arguments that one of the reasons that the Assad regime chose to use chemical weapons, as it looks like that is what was happening recently, is that it was backed into a corner and it was looking for a way to kind of regain control of the situation as much as it could.
So your study was published last year, and you did this big statistical analysis. Where did you go about getting the data from, and how did you assemble it? Because I guess the trouble with any data set on a political issue is that, unlike, I mean, we cover a lot of science on the show, and people talk about papers, and obviously with scientific issues you can very much put different things in different boxes and do tests, whereas surely political data is very messy. I mean, how do you judge the start and the end of a conflict and so on?
Oh, that's a really good question, and data issues are kind of the quintessential bugbear of statistical analysis. And our analyses can, of course, only be as good as the data we're using. For this study, we relied on a fairly well-known data set, at least in the conflict literature, from the Uppsala Conflict Data Program from Uppsala University in Sweden. And they've compiled data set of violence against civilians. You'll notice in the paper we use the term one-sided violence, which is taken from their data set. So that is what they call direct and intentional violence against a civilian population, so or unarmed non-combatants. That excludes collateral damage. So our study is really looking in many ways at the worst types of violence, right? This is when a government or a rebel group intentionally targets civilians for lethal violence. It's not a byproduct of the conflict. It's not civilians dying from starvation and malnutrition. You know, this is rounding up civilians and executing them, or intentionally bombing a village, or any of the other nasty things we can imagine armed actors doing in a conflict. And so their data are collected from a variety of sources, mostly news sources, publicly available news sources. And I don't have a list in front of me of all of the media sources they use. And so that is a limitation, though, is that we're, if anything, likely to be underreporting the actual violence that goes on, both because of the restrictive definition we use and because, you know, the data used for the analysis is collected from the media. And we know, of course, there are lots of cases of civilian killings that go unreported. So that's where the data on the civilians come from. And then, if I recall, the sample for civil wars is also from a Uppsala Conflict Data Program data set, which they labeled their dyadic data set. So it's a pairing of a government with a rebel force. So for our study, it's a specific rebel group over the time period in which it's involved in a conflict with the government. And they set thresholds at, I think, fairly conservative levels. So it's the conflict has to produce 25 battle deaths. So those would be the deaths of soldiers in a year. And it continues to be active for as long as at least 25 soldiers are killed on either side through the conflict.
What would you say the broad takeaway points from this analysis were?
Well, for us, the takeaway point was really a confirmation of some existing arguments that shifts in the balance of power or the emergence of adverse conditions shape a political actor's decisions regarding targeting civilians during a conflict. So I guess to put that more succinctly, when rebels or government are losing ground or losing power relative to their adversary, they tend to fight dirty. So those are the conditions under which we're likely to see violence against civilians. So we look at one specific mechanism that would shift the balance of power. As you might imagine, foreign military intervention that backs one side and necessarily opposes the other side of the conflict. And so that causes a significant shift in the capabilities ratio, or the balance of power between the two groups. And so it's those conditions that lead to attacks on civilians.
One of the conclusions, I think, that you drew was that intervention does generally make the other side more likely to attack civilians. So if we were to intervene to help the Syrian rebels, it would make Assad more likely to attack civilians again. But could this work the other way?
if I'm reading your study correctly, the side that we help also are less likely to, you know, attack civilians. So could us intervening prevent the sort of, you know, the Al-Qaeda type elements from doing particularly awful things? Could that help suppress violence there?
Well, that's an interesting question. That is what we find in the study, is that the side that receives the assistance becomes less likely to target civilians. I think in the case of the Syrian rebels, you know, they haven't relied very heavily on violence against the civilian population. So I guess I wouldn't anticipate a significant drop. They're already at such a low level, particularly compared to the Assad regime. You know, I'm a little hesitant to speculate how our intervention might shape their behaviors. I would be concerned that our intervention would actually cause an increase in factionalization among the group. You know, we make the assumption in this paper that the rebel group and the governments are essentially unitary actors, right? And we don't consider that there are different interests at stake within each of those units. And we know very well that in Syria, and this was, of course, this has been an ongoing discussion within the U.S. and British governments, that, you know, there are multiple parties within, you know, calling it a rebel army is something of a misnomer. It's really a collection of rebel armies, plural. And so while the more secular and I think Western-oriented factions would probably benefit significantly from intervention by the West and might conform to our expectations a little bit, right? Continue to use low levels of violence against civilians. I worry that, you know, much in the same way that we see this shift in capabilities driving behavior, we might see the more extremist elements feel that they're alienated and their relative power within the rebel movement is declining and actually resort to violence. So sorry, that kind of adds it. And of course, we didn't explore that in this paper, right? We made some simplifying assumptions and that would be one way to complicate it a little more. So I think that's tricky, and the effect of intervention, of course, is going to depend on the character of the groups supported or opposed.
And I guess thinking about your paper in a sort of wider context, I think in the paper you agreed with another paper that said that the attempts to rule by sort of just sheer violence increases when power is diminishing, when they are backed into a corner. Do you think this is sort of explains why we've seen, you know, protesters being crushed and so on in Turkey and Egypt and so on? Is it the same phenomena?
We know very well from the literature that governments respond. Actually, Christian Davenport has coined a term, the law of coercive response, and that when governments are challenged, they strike back. And so that would fit, I think, with you know, what you're seeing in Egypt and what we saw earlier this year in Turkey. You know, generally speaking, governments, particularly non-democratic governments, but also democratic governments to a degree, are not usually very pleased with open challenges to their rule. And so we tend to see, again, even in democracies, that protests that directly challenge the regime, particularly that look to threaten its stability and its control over the population, are met with some kind of coercive response. Now, the severity of that response, you know, whether it's you know, increased censorship or a few arrests versus, you know, gunning down protesters in the street, depends both on the severity of the or the strength of the challenge to the government, but also to constraints on the government itself. So I think that in some ways, yeah, your kind of speculation there is correct, that the size of the challenge, even in protests, kind of influences the severity of the response.
Finally, to wrap things up then, but what do you think the likely outcome for Syria is if military action is or isn't taken?
Again, I should probably say we're not making any policy recommendations, and of course I can't speak for my co-authors. I think that regardless of the long-term outcome, I don't think that it would be good to be vague about it. In more specific, I think that, you know, regardless of whether we intervene or not, a lot more civilians are going to be killed and killed intentionally by the regime. I think that for the U.S. and for Britain and other Western countries that are interested in intervening, they kind of have to consider the trade-off between a significant uptick in violence immediately, which I would anticipate if we did intervene, right? There will be some backlash, and, you know, maybe a decline in violence down the road once there's a new regime in place. But it's that it's that period in between, you know, where we're really not sure what the severity of the violence would be. You know, we don't have to look very far to see what the consequences are of an intervention that ousts an autocratic regime from power, right? I mean, Iraq is right next door, and I'm certainly not the first person to draw a comparison there. And I think that's definitely something that's on the minds of policymakers. I see a lot of reason to think that the outcome would not be that dissimilar. Maybe not to the same scale. I think there's probably a little less likelihood of widespread sectarian conflict, although I think there's still the possibility of that. Of course, the Assad's regime is Alawite, and that's a minority group. They're, of course, clinging to power in part because they recognize that once they're out of power, they lose a lot of the benefits that accrue to them from that position. So, you know, I unfortunately think that, you know, even if intervention looks like it might serve the long-term interests of removing a despot, you know, a violent despot, that, you know, in the interim, it is going to create significant hardship for the civilian population.
And on that note, we'll leave it there, Reid. It's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Staying in Syria now, and it's time to think about chemical weapons. One of the key disputes in the ongoing debate about whether we should do something or not is, why are chemical weapons worse than normal weapons? If 100 people die, does it matter if they were chemical weapons or bombs that did it? This week, Drew Ray has been looking back at why chemical weapons rules exist.
This week, the apparent use of chemical weapons in Syria saw the US government declare that they had crossed a red line, and UK politicians start to see red. But what is it about chemical weapons in particular that raises our ire, as opposed to all those other weapons that leave people equally maimed or dead? The laws of war primarily deal with limiting unnecessary destruction, and historically they've mostly been self-imposed. It's generally been considered okay to do anything which furthers your legitimate political objectives, but not okay to go around causing hurt and destruction just for its own sake. One application of this general principle is to say that it's okay to target military people and military assets, but not okay to hurt non-combatants, such as prisoners and civilians. This makes sense for major powers, since hurting non-combatants doesn't generally help your military objectives, and it just encourages the other side to retaliate, hurting your non-combatants. On the other hand, if you're the weaker party in a conflict, and you don't ever hope winning a stand-up fight, then hurting non-combatants may in fact be a strategy which furthers your political objectives. Hence, guerrillas, who are very happy to go around targeting non-military targets. For a long time, that's pretty much how the game was played. The main players set rules for themselves, which were self-enforced because they were a good idea. Even if you were a totally unethical bastard, you wouldn't actually gain strategic advantage by breaking the rules. Underdogs routinely broke the rules, and this was labelled as a bad thing by the main players, who made moral arguments explaining why targeting civilians and prisoners was inherently evil. Civilians were never totally off limits, though. A clear example of this is the old English tradition of targeting merchant shipping. Piracy for its own sake, done by other people? Evil. Privateering in pursuit of national strategic objectives? Hunky-dory. At around the time of the American Civil War, the game changed. You can dispute exactly when it changed, but the American Civil War is a big, well-known example at around the right time, so I'm going to use it as my case in point. Both sides of the war considered themselves main players, in the sense that they both thought they could win a stand-up fight. However, both sides depended so much on population, agriculture, and industrial infrastructure, that they realized they could secure a genuine military advantage by attacking civilian property. The results were devastating. The South bore the most hardship, but since they were going back to being one country anyway afterwards, it was clear that absolute warfare actually reduced the gains even for the winner. Politicians, diplomats, soldiers, philosophers, they all had to come to a new understanding of the rules of war. to avoid war being so harmful that neither side won, both sides had to come to an agreement about what was allowed or not allowed. The rules of war had to actually stop each side doing things that would otherwise be a good military idea. A side effect of this is that you could now gain a strategic advantage by being ruthless enough to break the rules, at least in the short term. Break the rules too blatantly or too often, and the other side would simply start ignoring the rules too. That last problem has always existed. When fighting against guerrillas, armies have always been very tempted to break the self-imposed rules that they use when fighting regular armies. That's sometimes worked and sometimes not. We'll come back to that. The main purpose of this segment is to talk about one of the mutually agreed rules in particular, which covers chemical weapons. The first thing to realise is that there doesn't have to be anything particularly special about chemical weapons to make us ban them. If you're going to have an arbitrary set of rules to limit both sides, you can put whatever you want into those rules. The Hague Conventions of 1899 and 1907 banned both chemical weapons and dropping bombs out of balloons. Now, just in case you think there's a humanitarian thread linking these things together, forget it. The link between the two things is not indiscriminate destruction, but the fact that they were both potential game changers. Before, during, and after the negotiations, everyone was busy developing poison gas and air power. They were just trying to use the Hague Conventions to slow down their opposition. Fast forward to World War I, and the cynicism is revealed. Both sides used bombers and poison gas indiscriminately. After the war, though, chemical weapons became a part of the new Geneva Conventions, whereas strategic bombing became a centerpiece of military glory. And there's one simple reason for this. Battlefield chemical weapons didn't work. There were a couple of early successes where they were used by surprise, but later World War I tactics showed that you could get just about the same advantage with none of the problems using simple smoke. In the main, poison gas caused lots of horrific casualties, disproportionately few actual fatalities, and it introduced chaos for both sides, anathema to the carefully planned assaults that characterised the conflict. In other words, chemical weapons failed the long-standing test for self-imposed rules of war. They cause harm and destruction without furthering your military objectives. Hence, come World War II, where we had at least four national leaders competing for spots in the ruthless bastard of the year calendar, we still didn't have significant use of poison gas. Unrestricted submarine warfare? Yes. Firebombing civilians? Sure, why not? Strategic nuclear weapons? You betcha. Poison gas? Not so much. So if it's a practical, pragmatic, self-imposed decision not to use chemical weapons, why are we so annoyed when other people have or use them? Well, remember those guerrillas throughout history? And how major powers get so annoyed when other people fight using different rules? We choose not to use chemical weapons on practical grounds, which we call moral grounds, so it seems incredibly evil to us when other people do it. They're facing a different moral equation, though. If they think chemical weapons actually help them meet military or political goals, then they actually meet the old-fashioned rule of war test. Unfortunately for Syria, they aren't fighting in the 16th century, when rules of war were self-imposed. They aren't fighting in the 19th or earlier 20th century, when bilateral agreements about rules created limits for the scale of the conflict. They're part of an international community, where even non-participants think they have a right to pass judgment on the way a war is being fought, and sometimes to even stop being non-participants as a result. Of course, even if Syria has used poison gas, the rules of war still do apply for the rest of us. Do we have a legitimate military or political aim, which is advanced by whatever action we take? This is Drew Ray, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
so that's why we don't allow chemical weapons. But what are the moral arguments behind it? And why are chemical weapons so disgusting? Rich Godby here has been trying to figure it out.
There's something particularly disturbing about the idea of chemical weapons. Something visceral and physical that goes beyond the fear of annihilation caused by other WMDs. Unlike nuclear weapons that are described as terrifying or devastating, chemical weapons invoke words such as disgusting and horrifying. Nick Clegg called their use a repugnant crime, and François Hollande called the decision to use them vile. Steven Pinker described them as an abhorrence and abominable. But why does this type of weapon engender feelings of disgust and aversion? One of the most intriguing things about aversions, particularly disgust, is that they are what you might call third-party emotions. Many emotions, like joy and anger, are emotions we feel because of an object or event, whereas others, like abomination, disgust, and fright, are not only something we feel, but a label we place upon the object that has caused the feeling. So we feel abomination towards the abominable, disgust towards the disgusting, and fright towards the frightening. Nuclear weapons, fallout aside, are frightening. Chemical weapons are disgusting. But why is that? In this segment, I will look briefly at the phenomenon of disgust and how it relates to chemical weapons. Firstly, perhaps chemical weapons are a potential indiscriminate harm. Those things we feel aversion towards are not those things which will harm us, like a bomb or a bullet, but those things that could harm us and the people we love. Somehow a gas attack has a potentiality for harm that explosives do not. If we get blown up, we get blown up. But if gas lands at our feet, we can get out of the way. It's not a definite harm. We also see these weapons as somehow organic in the biological sense of the term organic. The way these chemicals affect the inner workings of the body, rather than just blowing chunks out of them, makes them invasive. This organic chemical entity needs a way into the body as well. The nose and the mouth are the ground zero of disgust, and they are also the ground zero of chemical weapons. These chemicals are breathed in through the nose and the mouth, traditionally where food, the very fabric of life, enters our bodies and gives us pleasure. The chemicals do so, most of us would expect, with a taste and a smell that is almost unbearable. Disgust in its purest form is a physical reaction of the body. This might lead to another movement through the orifices, this time in the wrong direction. The nose and mouths expel the poison, the eyes may also stream, and perhaps your bowels become difficult to control. Another signature of disgust and aversion is a response to an unbearable overabundance of something. Think, for example, of our reaction to something modestly sweet as opposed to something oversweetened. Or the difference between imagining a single insect on your arm or your arm covered in insects. Or the smell of a silly child stink bomb compared to how you might expect a chemical weapon to smell. Chemical weapons are also a contaminant. They spread quickly with no particular target, moving from one to the next, infecting each person within range. They infect through orifices and keep on infecting, unlike a bomb which explodes, kills, and it's over. Chemical weapons linger, and they continue to affect more and more for some undisclosed amount of time. The only other weapon with a similar impact is a nuclear weapon, and it's not the explosion but the fallout that causes the most intense feelings of horror and repugnance. Another effect is that of monstrosity. It is certainly true that more conventional weapons can horribly maim, but something of the way a chemical infects the tissue of our bodies to transform it at the organic level makes such weapons more horrific, more terrible, more abominable. The monstrous malformations of the body it causes, especially in children, create sensations in us not only of anger, but of repugnance. The horror of the child's appearance is substituted with an abhorrence for the weapon that caused it, and a disgust towards the person that used it. Psychology tells us that disgust is a way the central nervous system, and particularly the amygdala and the insula, keep us away from contaminating microbes. Before we understood microbes, 17th century thinkers such as Thomas Wright and Thomas Hobbes suggested that what they called hatred of abomination or aversion was a need to avoid a potential harm. In 1649, René Descartes called it horreur. He suggested it was a type of desire, the, quote, desire that tends to the search for good and the avoidance of evil, end quote. He later qualified this vividly with the idea that the cause might be, quote, the touch of a little worm or the rustling of a trembling leaf or its shadow, end quote. Chemical weapons are not microbes, but they are biological harm. They are an evil to be avoided. They are a touch of a little worm, a harm from which we must move away. But more than that, they are dirty. One of the most famous quotable quotes in anthropology is that of Mary Douglas, who in her book Purity and Danger said that dirties, quote, matter out of place, end quote. Chemical weapons are that. They rearrange matter at the biological level. They also rearrange it at a moral level. The key to the recent outrage over Syria is the simple truth that many see chemical weapons as more immoral than other types of weapon. This is to do with their disgusting dirtiness, their out-of-placeness in a number of ways. We do not feel morally fearful or morally desperate. We don't even feel morally angry. Indignation is more than just anger. It has elements of desperation, frustration, and honour. But we do feel morally disgusted. Disgust and morality have been bedfellows for centuries, since the word disgust entered the English language. And other feelings of aversion had negative moral implications even before that. The physical sensation and the morality of disgust are difficult to separate. To do something that causes sensations of disgust on purpose is morally disgusting. The use of the kind of tactics that such weapons allow take us back to the early days of just war theory. Back to the 13th century when Thomas Aquinas attempted to create rules for just war. These include two that chemical weapons have a problem with. Proportionality and discrimination. Proportionality is a proportional response. And discrimination is to discriminate between civilians and combatants. Chemical weapons are out of place with these notions, and these are notions that the United Nations and war crimes tribunals take very seriously, even if they weren't taken all that seriously when Thomas Aquinas worked them out in the 13th century. These weapons, because of their destructive potential and the way they cannot be used safely within a just war, whatever that is, generate feelings of moral disgust, particularly in politicians. History is filled with disgust and aversion being used as a reason for war, perhaps more so than anger. Disgust is certainly a significant ingredient in propaganda, as it can vilify an enemy. Disgusting acts can make a person, or a nation, or a race disgusting. For example, Goebbels' use of the rat to sell to the Germans the disgusting nature of Jews. It dehumanizes people. Using chemical weapons is a disgusting, dehumanizing act and a strong, if knee-jerk, reason to go to war. And the upshot is, the disgusting act can demonize, dehumanize, and make disgusting the person who carried it out. This is the Abominable History Man, Richard Firth Godby here, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Now I know what you're thinking, the chemical weapon stuff is a bit grim and depressing, can't we talk about something lighter? So in this next segment I've been talking to an archaeologist about the bubonic plague, which someone actually died of this week in Kyrgyzstan. Though obviously this is sad news, it does mean that at least now we know at least one fact about Kyrgyzstan. So yeah, the plague is still about. Who knew? Well, one of the people who did is Alison Atkin. I started by asking her to explain her credentials.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. As you said, my name is Alison Atkin. I'm currently a doctoral researcher at the University of Sheffield. I'm actually an archaeologist. I specialise in human osteology, which is the study of human remains and human bones. So not an epidemiologist, as you might expect, studying the plague, but I am looking at the Black Death in medieval England. So I do read quite a lot about it.
And the reason we're talking to you today is because the plague, the Black Death, has been found, alive and well in Kyrgyzstan. Is this actually the same plague as the one we all think of?
Yeah, so a lot of people are actually quite surprised when I talk about my research. The biggest shock for them is that the Black Death or the plague is still around. So this is the new story that out of Kyrgyzstan this week, like you said, that a 15-year-old herder, Timur Aysanakunov, died of the plague last week. And it's most likely that he acquired this from a flea bite. This is indeed the same disease that was given the name the Black Death that occurred during the medieval period, and which is what most people think of when they hear plague.
Is this common? And should we be worried that it's still happening?
I don't think there's any need to be worried. I don't think we all need to batten down the hatches or anything like that. But it is still quite, I wouldn't say common, but it's not uncommon. Last year in 2012, there were about 400 cases of the plague reported to the World Health Organization. But it's thought that there's probably more, around 1,000 to 3,000 around the world each year. It's just that some probably aren't reported. Most of these cases nowadays occur in Africa, in Democratic Republic of Congo and Madagascar, but there have been a few outbreaks in recent years outside of these areas.
So how does the plague actually transmit, and why is it still around? Because my assumption was it had died out. Is it that there's fleas or other animals that are just sitting hidden away, carrying the stuff, waiting to bite people?
Yeah. So the plague, it's an infection that's caused by a bacteria. And it's a zoonotic disease, which means it generally lives within an animal population, in this case, usually rodent population. So things like rats and prairie dogs and marmosets and things like that. So after the Black Death, there was actually a third pandemic, and this happened in the 19th century in China. And actually became a pandemic and spread around the world. And so it hasn't really gone away ever. It's always been sort of endemic in the population. And what happens is you get these sort of reservoirs of the disease where the bacteria lives within various animals, and then it's transmitted between them by fleas, and occasionally humans become infected. Thankfully, we don't make very good hosts for the disease. We're not as resistant to it as rodents, and we're not as desirable a place to live for fleas and things like that, which is why it can sort of just carry on in the background, living among these animals, and every once in a while it sort of rears its head by infecting a human.
So if it does break out, how do we get rid of it? Is it easy? Do we need a great fire like we did in the 17th century to get rid of it?
Probably not, actually. I guess one of the nice things about this is because it is caused by a bacteria, it is quite easily treated with antibiotics. One of the issues, though, is that you obviously have to be treated quite early on. In the case of this individual who died last week, the doctors didn't diagnose the illness as plague until after he had died. But if you're treated relatively early, within the first 24 hours or the first few days, then you have a pretty good chance of recovery. In the case of bubonic plague, which is the most common form of plague, if you're treated by antibiotics, then most of the cases will recover and survive. With other forms of the disease, it's a little bit more complicated. There's also a form called pneumonic plague, which happens when the bacteria gets into your lungs. And this is a lot more deadly and it progresses a lot more quickly. So you do need to be treated with antibiotics sort of within the first 24 hours. Otherwise, your chances aren't very good. So with the Great Fire of London, so that sort of happened. That was 1665, 1666 was the last episode of the plague in England. But at this time, it was already starting to die out. It wasn't occurring as frequently in England. It actually was dying out in other areas in Europe as well. So there's sort of a divided opinion as to whether or not the Great Fire was what finally expunged it from our shores, or whether it was already on its way out.
So why was it, thinking historically now, why was it on its way out? Did it simply kill too many people for there to be sort of a critical mass of people to carry it or something?
Yeah, well, this is sort of the million-dollar question. There's been a lot of debate over the years as to whether the plague that existed in the first pandemic, so this is the Justinian plague during the Roman times, the medieval plague, were actually the same disease as the modern plague. And more recent research on the DNA has shown that these are indeed the same diseases, but people have sort of been trying to answer this question as to why was it so much more deadly in the past than it has been today. And obviously, we have antibiotics now. But in the third pandemic in China and around the world, we didn't have the antibiotics then, but it was still less virulent. It was less deadly. There are many reasons this could be. It could be to do with the climate and the change. It could also be that obviously a lot of us live in quite nice houses nowadays. We don't have a lot of rats living around us. We're more aware of being able to control these vectors, so killing off animals if we know that there's a bit of a disease, things like that. So in terms of whether or not the disease just killed off too many people, that's probably not the case. That was suggested quite early on into research into the plague that humans, we were far overpopulated, so the plague sort of came to wipe us out and to let us carry on. But if it's probably not the case, as we're now a much more populous species and the same sort of thing isn't happening. It was probably much more to do with levels of hygiene, living in the close proximity of the types of animals that are vectors for it, such as living around more rats and things like that. And people were living in much closer contact to things like fleas and things that were able to transmit the disease, and people just weren't able to treat it, so it was able to pass along. Whereas nowadays we've had changes in infrastructure and things like that as well, so it's just not as effective at transmitting between people.
Do you know much about the, and I realise this might be a bit of a curveball question depending on your knowledge, do you know much about the sort of historical development of, is it a case of we're now not too worried because we've had, so that, you know, we've figured out germ theory and all these other things and developed all these drugs, or was there a time when it re-emerged and we knew a bit, we were bricking it?
I'm not sure, but I know that certainly in the medieval period and during the Black Death, obviously most people thought that the plague was caused by the wrath of God. It was caused by their sins. They didn't know about germ theory, although there was obviously a sense of contamination because they knew that people who came in close contact with those people who had the disease were more likely to get it. You have stories of people not reusing clothes or belongings of the dead or covering their faces. People were also less keen to become in contact with the dead body, so to do various rituals and rites after a person had died and to bury them and things like that. So there was a sense that it could be caught, but they didn't really know why. And the general consensus was that people had been sinful and therefore they were being punished, and there wasn't really anything that they could do about it. They could try to run away, but it usually came with them. Whereas in the third pandemic, obviously people had this idea of germ theory. They knew what germs were. And so there was sort of a race to try and discover what was responsible for it, and indeed to try and create something that could be used to treat it. So there are actually plague vaccines. It's just that they don't work very well. It's quite difficult to vaccinate against bacteria, and it has a pretty serious side effects as well. So that's something that's still being worked on, because I think one of the biggest risks with something like this is the weaponization of something like the plague bacteria, which is obviously not a nice thing to think about.
Mm. And you were talking a minute ago about how people blamed God and it was all to do with going close to bodies and stuff. Now, am I right in thinking your research is to do with the disposal of bodies in during the plague and stuff? Would you be able to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so obviously, as I've been yammering on about the actual bacteria of the plague, my research is actually in how people responded to these epidemics in the past. Specifically, right now, my PhD is looking at how people disposed of bodies of individuals who died of the Black Death. And this is especially important because obviously we know that even with conservative estimates, millions of individuals died. But to date, we've identified very few of them in the archaeological records, which seems a bit unusual because you would think if that many people had died, we would have found more of them by now. With my estimates, it maybe suggests that we've only found 1% to 2% of them, which is not very many. Some reasons for this might be that obviously a lot of the archaeological work that's done when we encounter human remains isn't, we don't go out there and say, let's dig up the cemetery, I'm interested to see what's in it. It's, I'm developing a building and, oh, look, we found some skeletons. So it's possibly to do with that. So I'm working to the hypothesis that while there are mass graves, and we know that these exist, especially with the large ones that have been found down in London. There's also another one in Hereford, which are the two big ones that have been discovered in England. The theory is that people were actually being buried in what we would call the normative manner. So they weren't necessarily being disposed of in these mass graves. They were being still buried in individual graves, being given the normative and regular burial rites, and they were buried within regular cemetery grounds. So because the plague doesn't show up on the bones, because it kills you relatively quickly, and it doesn't have any time to make changes to the structure of the body, they look just the same as anybody else when you excavate them from a cemetery. So what I'm trying to do is to distinguish between cemeteries where we might have just people who have died regularly over time from, you know, illness or old age and things like that, and the cemeteries where we have a combination of sort of the regular deaths and those that have died during a mass epidemic, where you get a different subset of the population that's being killed off all at the same time.
That's really interesting. I mean, and again, I'm grasping at half-remembered knowledge, but I'm sure I remember reading a while back that they found some plague graves when they were digging the Crossrail tunnels in London.
Yes.
If the bones don't show any evidence of this, how did they know they were plague-related?
Yes, well, these ones that they found down in Crossrails is very interesting, because it does kind of support my research at the minute, which was sort of a moment of triumph when I read the stories. So these ones, they do know from documentary records that victims of the plague were buried in certain areas. There are grants of land being given specifically for this purpose, which is incredibly useful if you have the documents. But there are lots of areas where we don't have documents anymore. So with these ones, they suspected that they might encounter some of these burials. And these burials that they found in the most recent case in this excavation for the Crossrails, these were buried individually, so they're buried in neat, nice, ordered rows and individual graves in sort of the fashion that you would expect for Christian burials of this time. And so they're going to be doing some ADNA testing to try and identify the pathogen within these individuals. And it's incredibly likely that they will find this and be able to show that these were indeed victims of the plague. And this is the bit that's interesting to me, is because even at other sites where you have mass graves, you also have regular, ordered handling of the dead and traditional burial of the dead. It's just we tend to focus on the mass graves because they're slightly more interesting. People find them a bit more exciting. They're more unusual. But I think it's incredibly interesting that people were still burying people regularly, that they were taking the time and that they were making the effort to ensure that people had what they considered the proper burial. And it was only when the number of dead people outstripped sort of the resources of the living that they would resort to either multiple graves, so maybe two or three people sharing a burial plot, to mass graves where you have trenches that are filled with hundreds of people.
It all sounds fascinating, and it's fascinating to hear you sort of overturning the sort of I guess it's almost received wisdom. I mean, in my head, if I think of the plague, I think of it looking like World War Z or something. But on that note, Alison, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
So far this week, we've talked about a Russian-backed dictator being a bit of a dick and a former Soviet possession having the plague. So how else has Russia been spoiling our fun lately? You may have heard about the shitstorm surrounding next year's Sochi Winter Olympic Games, which has faced calls for a boycott from some gay rights groups and supporters. But is a boycott the answer? If anyone knows the answer to this, it's going to be Mark, who works for the Gay Games, an organisation who organise a big inclusive sporting event every 4 years. Here he is to give us his take.
As you may have heard, this coming February, athletes and TV crews from around the world will be flocking to Sochi, a Russian Black Sea resort, for the Winter Olympic and Paralympic Games. As you may also have heard, Russia is not a very nice place, at least if you're any shade of queer, or if you're just a person who dares express the opinion that LGBT people are perhaps not a plague on society. Russia was already not a very nice place 7 years ago, when the International Olympic Committee chose it to host these games. But as history shows, while the IOC is quite attentive as to how a host will protect the rights of its sponsors, it's not so interested in how a host will protect the rights of the athletes, coaches, press, and spectators of the games. I'll note in passing that Principle 4 of the Olympic Charter declares that sport is a human right. and that Principle 6 of the Charter says that discrimination in sport is contrary to participation in the Olympic movement. So they say. The laws in Russia are horrible, and have arisen from and given license to an atmosphere of often violent homophobia throughout the country. The IOC's reaction to the situation has been less than stellar. They've engaged in a kabuki show with Russian authorities, feigning concern about the laws while ignoring Russian provocations, such as declarations that the law would, of course, be applied. Duh, it's the law. The IOC now accepts Russian assurances that no one in Sochi will be arrested for being gay, and that the law isn't discriminatory in any case because it applies to people both gay and straight. This is rather like proponents of America's anti-miscegenation laws claiming that they weren't racist because they not only prevented blacks from marrying whites, but whites from marrying blacks. The law is written to be intentionally vague and bans propaganda of non-traditional relationships. The IOC rules, in particular Rule 50, are similarly vague, again banning political propaganda. The advantage of being vague is that by avoiding stating clearly what behavior is prohibited, you encourage everyone to censor themselves. Is wearing a rainbow pin propaganda? Is saying you think people should be treated equally propaganda? Why should simply defending equality be considered propaganda in the first place? In the absence of clear rules, athletes and others seeking security will err on the side of silence. So how should the world, and in particular Olympic athletes, respond? Some have called for more general action against Russia. Some of these campaigns have potential for impact, such as travel bans on targeted Russian lawmakers and officials. Others seem to be more anecdotal, such as not drinking a particular brand of vodka that may or may not be Russian. I'm a member of the Federation of Gay Games, itself a partner in an international coalition aimed at taking action in response to the situation in Russia. We're a sports organization in charge of the Gay Games, the world's largest sporting event open to all, so our focus has been on Sochi, and more broadly on the responsibility of sport governing bodies such as the IOC. So what should an organization like the Federation of Gay Games and our partners in Pride House International do? Some have called for a boycott of the Sochi Olympics. We haven't, and we won't. A boycott will not work. We need to be ambitious and optimistic about what can be achieved, but should not be wasting our energy on initiatives that are doomed to fail. Likewise, for moving the Games to Vancouver or another location, or banning the Russian Olympic team from competing in Sochi, or requiring Russian athletes to compete under the Olympic flag rather than their national flag. An International Olympic Committee, whose response to outrage over holding the Olympics in homophobic Russia is to remind athletes that they must not engage in political propaganda, is hardly likely to be willing to take any of these steps. As organizations promoting the visibility of LGBT athletes in sport, we cannot tell athletes to stay home. And in particular, we can't tell LGBT athletes that their duty is to boycott these games. There are very few out athletes that will be participating in Sochi. Among them is Gay Games ambassador Blake Skellerup. He's a short track speed skater from New Zealand, and he's announced that if he's selected for Sochi, he'll be there as an out gay man, and he'll proudly wear his rainbow pin from the London 2012 Olympics. We applaud his courage and support his participation in these games. At the same time, the IOC has announced that it will double-team with the Russian authorities. An athlete who engages in political propaganda can be arrested by the Russians and sanctioned by the IOC. We think back to the recent World Athletics Championships in Moscow, where a Swedish athlete who dared paint her fingernails in the colors of the rainbow was threatened by her own national federation. In Sochi, will a medal winner be disqualified for raising the hands of her rival on the podium? Will a skier be sanctioned for embracing his husband at the end of a race? Will a skater be punished for skating to Lady Gaga's Born This Way? Just as it would be absurd to consider an athlete wearing a Star of David on a chain, or an athlete crossing herself before her race, as participating in religious propaganda, which is also banned under IOC rules, simply saying or showing you're gay cannot be grounds for disqualification, and the IOC must make this very clear immediately. Nor should saying that you value sport for all or that sport should not discriminate be considered political propaganda. Perhaps most absurd are some athletes themselves, who have likened speaking out for equality to a guest criticizing a host's dinner menu or interior decorating. Athletes in Sochi are not guests. The Russians bid for the right to carry out a commercial operation with the IOC. They are contractors, not hosts. Athletes have no choice about whether to go to Sochi or not. That's where the Olympics are taking place. They've not been invited by the Russians. They'll be selected by their national sporting bodies to represent their country. At the same time, we must never forget the millions of Russians who are living under the threat of these laws now and who will continue to suffer long after the TV cameras leave Sochi. While the cameras are on, we need to use them to point out the absurdity of these anti-gay laws. That's why the Federation of Gay Games and its partners in Pride House International have launched the Same-Sex Handholding Initiative. Some have called for athletes and others to wave rainbow flags or wear pink, but these efforts are difficult to coordinate, and they'd be blocked or punished by Russian and IOC authorities. Instead, we're calling on everyone in Sochi, not just athletes, to take every opportunity to hold hands with a person of the same sex. They'll be showing solidarity while highlighting how absurd a law about gay propaganda truly is. To raise awareness for this initiative, we're asking everyone to support the campaign by posting a photo of themselves holding hands with a person of the same sex on our photo blog at holdhandsinsochi.tumblr.com. That's holdhandsinsochi.tumblr.com. It's a small gesture, but you'll be helping every athlete, official, journalist, and spectator in Sochi learn that they can actually show that they don't think an athlete, or anyone, should be punished for saying they're gay. This is Mark Neymark for The Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. We appreciate all the donations as they help us keep making the show week in, week out. Also on our website, you can, of course, follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook, or indeed, find my CV and reasons why you should employ me. If you're a rich employer, why not pay me money to do something? Anything, really. You can find all that at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Rich Godby here, Drew Ray, Cash Farouk, Mark Neymark, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The Sketch in the Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
After studies showing that music competitions could be judged accurately by sight alone, we bring you an exciting new autumn TV lineup that'll tantalise your senses.
First, a brand new art appreciation show, where new and exciting works are appraised by sense of smell alone. That's Being Sniffy with Brian Sewell.
I have here a new installation by Tracy Emin. It whiffs of an aromatic avalanche, but chiefly sweaty kicks. How do you capture a gusset like that?
We bring you a new look cookery programme where Hugh Fernley Whittingstall listens to the sounds of all of your favourite dishes. That's Racket of Lamb.
And don't forget our flagship Saturday evening programme, The Face, where the judges spin around if they like the look of the miming singer.
Have they started? Can he turn around yet? Bloody hell, they haven't thought this format through, have they?
Hooah! That's what you've got to look forward to in our sensory swap around this autumn on the BBC.
What about Gokwan's How to Taste Good Naked?
No, Hefner wants that for Playboy TV.
Oh,